3. At last the interview with the governor took place too. Our dear, mild Ivan Osipovich had only just returned, and only just had time to hear the angry complaint from the club. There was no doubt that something must be done, but he was troubled. The hospitable old man seemed also rather afraid of his young kinsman. He made up his mind, however, to induce him to apologize to the club, and to his victim in satisfactory form, and, if required, by letter, and then to persuade him to leave us for a time. Travelling, for instance, to improve his mind, in Italy, or in fact, anywhere abroad. In the waiting room in which, on this occasion, he received Nikolai Vsyevolodovitch, who had been at other times privileged as a relation to wander all over the house unchecked, Alyosha Telyatnikov, a clerk of refined manners, who was also a member of the governor's household, was sitting in a corner, opening envelopes at a table, and in the next room, at the window nearest to the door, a stout and sturdy colonel, a former friend and colleague of the governor, was sitting alone, reading the Colossus, paying no attention, of course, to what was taking place in the waiting room. In fact, he had his back turned. Ivan Osipovich approached the subject in a roundabout way, almost in a whisper, but kept getting a little muddled. Nikolai looked anything but cordial, not at all as a relation should. He was pale, and sat looking down, and continually moving his eyebrows, as though trying to control acute pain. "You have a kind heart and a generous one, Nicholas," the old man put in, among other things. "You're a man of great culture. You've grown up in the highest circles. And here, too, your behaviour has hitherto been a model, which has been a great consolation to your mother, who is so precious to all of us. And now and again, everything has appeared in such an unaccountable light, so detrimental to all. I speak as a friend of your family, as an old man who loves you sincerely, and a relation, at whose words you cannot take offence. Tell me, what drives you to such reckless proceedings, so contrary to all accepted rules and habits? What can be the meaning of such acts, which seem almost like outbreaks of delirium?" Nikolai listened with vexation and impatience. All at once, there was a gleam of something sly and mocking in his eyes. "I'll tell you what drives me to it," he said sullenly, and looking round him, he bent down to Ivan Osipovich's ear. The refined Alyosha Telyatnikov moved 3 steps farther away towards the window, and the colonel coughed over the Kolos. Poor Ivan Osipovich hurriedly and trustfully inclined his ear. He was exceedingly curious. And then something utterly incredible, though on the other side only too unmistakable, took place. The old man suddenly felt that, instead of telling him some interesting secret, Nikolai had seized the upper part of his ear between his teeth and was nipping it rather hard. He shuddered, and breath failed him.
"Nikola, this is beyond a joke," he moaned mechanically in a voice not his own.
Alyosha and the colonel had not yet grasped the situation. Besides, they couldn't see, and fancied up to the end that the two were whispering together. And yet the old man's desperate face alarmed them. They looked at one another with wide-open eyes, not knowing whether to rush to his assistance as agreed or to wait. Nikolai noticed this, perhaps, and bit the harder.
"Nicholas! Nicholas!" his victim moaned again. "Come! You've had your joke, that's enough!"
In another moment the poor governor would certainly have died of terror, but the monster had mercy on him and let go his ear. The old man's deadly terror lasted for a full minute, and it was followed by a sort of fit. Within half an hour Nikolai was arrested and removed for the time to the guard-room, where he was confined in a special cell, with a special sentinel at the door. This decision was a harsh one,
but our mild governor was so angry that he was prepared to take the responsibility, even if he had to face Varvara Petrovna. To the general amazement, when this lady arrived at the governor's in haste and in nervous irritation to discuss the matter with him at once, she was refused admittance, whereupon, without getting out of the carriage, she returned home, unable to believe her senses. And at last everything was explained. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the prisoner, who had till then been calm and had even slept, suddenly became noisy, began furiously beating on the door with his fists, with unnatural strength, wrenched the iron grating off the door, broke the window, and cut his hands all over. When the officer on duty ran with a detachment of men and the keys and ordered the cell to be opened that they might rush in and bind the maniac, it appeared that he was suffering from acute brain fever. He was taken home to his mother. Everything was explained at once. All our three doctors gave it as their opinion that the patient might well have been in a delirious state for 3 days before, and that though he might have apparently been in possession of full consciousness and cunning, yet he might have been deprived of common sense and will, which was indeed borne out by the facts. So it turned out that Liputin had guessed the truth sooner than anyone. Ivan Osipovich, who was a man of delicacy and feeling, was completely abashed. But what was striking was that he, too, had considered Nikolai Vsevolodovich capable of any mad action, even when in the full possession of his faculties. At the club, too, people were ashamed and wondered how it was they had failed to see the elephant and had missed the only explanation of all these marvels. There were, of course, sceptics among them, but they could not long maintain their position. Nikolai was in bed for more than 2 months. A famous doctor was summoned from Moscow for a consultation. The whole town called on Varvara Petrovna. She forgave them. When, in the spring, Nikolai had completely recovered and assented without discussion to his mother's proposal that he should go for a tour to Italy, she begged him further to pay visits of farewell to all the neighbours and, so far as possible, to apologise where necessary. Nikolai agreed with great alacrity. It became known at the club that he had had a most delicate explanation with Pyotr Pavlovich Gaganov at the house of the latter, who had been completely satisfied with his apology. As he went round to pay these calls, Nikolai was very grave and even gloomy. Everyone appeared to receive him sympathetically, but everybody seemed embarrassed and glad that he was going to Italy. Ivan Osipovich was positively tearful, but was, for some reason, unable to bring himself to embrace him, even at the final leave-taking. It is true that some of us retained the conviction that the scamp had simply been making fun of us, and that the illness was neither here nor there. He went to see Liputin, too. "Tell me," he said, "how could you guess beforehand what I should say about your sense and prime Agafya with an answer to it?" "Why," said Liputin, "it was because I recognized that you were a clever man, and so I foresaw what your answer would be." "Anyway, it was a remarkable coincidence. But excuse me, did you consider me a sensible man and not insane when you sent Agafya?" "For the cleverest and most rational, and I only pretended to believe that you were insane. And you guessed at once what was in my mind and sent a testimonial to my wit through Agafya." "Well, there you're a little mistaken. I really was unwell," muttered Nikolai Vsevolodovich, frowning. "Bah!" he cried. "Do you suppose I'm capable of attacking people when I'm in my senses? What object would there be in it?" Liputin shrank together and didn't know what to answer. Nikolai turned pale, or at least so it seemed to Liputin. "You have a very peculiar way of looking at things, anyhow," Nikolai went on. "But as for Agafya, I understand, of course, that you simply sent her to be rude to me. I couldn't challenge you to a duel, could I?
Oh, no, of course. I seem to have heard that you're not fond of duels. Why borrow from the French? Said Lipoutin, doubling up again. You're for nationalism, then. Lipoutin shrank into himself more than ever.
Bah, bah, what do I see? Cried Nicolas, noticing a volume of Considérant in the most conspicuous place on the table. You don't mean to say you're a Fourierist. I'm afraid you must be. And isn't this, too, borrowing from the French? He laughed, tapping the book with his finger.
No, that's not taken from the French, Lipoutin cried with positive fury, jumping up from his chair. That is taken from the universal language of humanity, not simply from the French. From the language of the universal social republic and harmony of mankind, let me tell you, not simply from the French.
Foo! Hang it all! There's no such language, laughed Nikolai.
Sometimes a trifle will catch the attention and exclusively absorb it for a time. Most of what I have to tell of young Stavrogin will come later, but I will note now as a curious fact that of all the impressions made on him by his stay in our town, the one most sharply imprinted on his memory was the unsightly and almost abject figure of the little provincial official, the coarse and jealous family despot, the miserly moneylender who picked up the candle ends and scraps left from dinner, and was, at the same time, a passionate believer in some visionary future social harmony, who at night gloated in ecstasies over fantastic pictures of a future phalanstery, and the approaching realization of which, in Russia and in our province, he believed as firmly as in his own existence, and that, in the very place where he had saved up to buy himself a little home, where he had married for the second time, getting a dowry with his bride, where perhaps, for 100 miles round, there was not one man, himself included, who was the very least like a future member of the universal human republic and social harmony. God knows how these people come to exist, Nikolai wondered, recalling the sometimes unlooked-for Fourierist.